You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Barbara Rashko. She's an artist that lives and works in New York City and divides her time between there and Alexandria, Virginia. She has a very busy career as an artist. She is represented by 6 galleries throughout the United States. But before that, she earned her BA in psychology, and after graduating, earned a commercial pilot's license before spending 7 years on active duty as a naval officer. After that, she left active duty and remained as a reserve working at the Pentagon and beginning her art career, which has blossomed at this point to quite active and busy career. Barbara, thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, thanks, Brainerd. I really appreciate it, being invited to speak.
Tell us a little bit about what's happening in your studio now. I've seen your work, of course, and known it for years, and looking over it all again, it seems the kind of work that's almost impossible to really understand completely without seeing it in person. And what I'm really talking about, because I know that you work with pastels, often on sandpaper, there's a richness to the blacks, a depth to the color that it seems the web just can't translate.
Yes, I think when my work is photographed, the way I work is I build up layers of soft pastel on sandpaper, and I probably have in some areas of the painting, I probably have 25 to 30 layers of pastel that builds up. I put it on the paper, I blend it with my fingers, it builds up, and by the time I finish the piece, it has this wonderful velvety kind of texture to it, and that's completely lost on any time my work is photographed or whenever it's not seen in person. I think that rich texture doesn't translate. That's kind of why I like to exhibit and why I prefer people just come to my studio and see the work in person.
And what is it that you're working on right now at the moment? Is there a particular series or image that you're working on?
Well, I'm continuing with a series that I began in 2007. It's called The Black Paintings. And I tend to work on a series for a long, long time. I think my previous series, I probably worked on 15 or 16 years. This particular piece, and I use Mexican folk art, also Guatemalan folk art, and I sort of started to branch out to other parts of the world. But the piece I'm working on now features a mask that I got in Cabo. I went to Cabo San Lucas with some friends in June, and I bought this mask, and I was pretty excited to find this piece, actually. And it's featured as the center piece in a painting I'm working on now. And it's the first time I've used this particular mask. I tend to reuse the figures in various paintings.
Now, the masks that you use and the figures are so interesting to me because they all seem to have different meanings for different people, I would imagine. And the mask in particular, well, maybe not in particular because I don't know that mask, but it seems
right to
carry kind of symbolic weight of some kind. Masks, these figures, everything seem to tell a story or have a narrative. But is there one that's meant to be in there?
I think so. But I think, you know, and I think that the way the pieces sort of attract me is kind of important. You know, I go to Mexico and I go to bazaars and markets and you know, these little stores, and you know, and I look at lots and lots of different figures, but certain ones seem to almost call out to me. They have sort of their own personality. Usually they're vibrant in color. They're kind of wild looking. And I like old things. Like, I try not to to buy things that were mass-produced for the tourist market. So I kind of think of them as having had a previous life. For example, I have a number of Judas figures, which are papier-mâché figures, usually with horns. They kind of look like devils. And a lot of them are made, well, they're made to be temporary, and they're used in Easter festivities in Mexico. They're basically made to be burned or exploded, like people put firecrackers in them, and then they blow them up on the Saturday morning before Easter in a kind of symbolic revenge against Judas for having betrayed Christ. So in that particular case, whenever I find a Judas, I feel like I've rescued it from a terrible end, you know, because they're basically made to be destroyed. Yes, yes.
Well, that's quite a story in itself, the regular rescuing of Judas by Barbara.
Yes, right, right.
So let's move back a little bit. How did you grow up? Were your parents artists?
No, not at all. I grew up in New Jersey in a pretty blue-collar town. My father was a TV repairman. My mother was mostly a stay-at-home homemaker. I'm not really sure where... unfortunately, I don't know my family history any further than my grandparents on both sides. So I don't really know... I mean, to my knowledge, there were no artists in my family. I don't really know where my artistic talents came from, excuse me. But and I have to say, I didn't get very much encouragement from my parents. Kind of when I was a kid, I took oil painting lessons for a number of years, mostly on my mother's initiative. My mother was always interested in art, although she in particular didn't have any artistic talent, but she was interested. She used to take my sister and I to museums when we were kids. And I think around the age of 5 or 6, I displayed some talent. I've always been able to draw anything that I can see. I used to copy the Sunday comics. I used to set up little still lifes, tabletop still lifes, and I would draw those. So I guess she realized I had some talent, and she enrolled my sister and I in Sunday morning art classes at the studio of a local teacher in Rutherford, New Jersey, a local painter. And I ended up studying with that painter for, I think I was like maybe 6 or 7 when I started, and I think I stopped when I was about 14. And the main reason I stopped was that my father, I guess my father, having grown up during the Depression and not having much contact with art, basically decided that art was a hobby and there was no future in it. I would never make any money. So he stopped paying for my lessons on Saturday morning. So, so I kind of, without any moral support, no financial support to take classes, I kind of let that side of my personality go dormant for quite a while, unfortunately, until I was about in my early 30s.
That's a long period, and during that time,
yes,
you had,
yes,
gotten your BA in psychology, and you began learning how to fly. Is that correct?
That's right. That's right. Yes, I don't know. I guess it's a complicated story. I went to college at the University of Vermont, and I graduated, moved back to Clifton, New Jersey, with my parents. I couldn't find a job. I ended up having a series of, it was a blue-collar town, as I mentioned. There really weren't jobs for college graduates. I ended up at one point as a driving instructor, I think I managed a movie theater for a while. I ended up, and I sold real estate. At one point, I decided, well, let me try selling real estate. I got my real estate license and was trying to sell real estate. I wasn't very good at it because, first of all, who's going to buy a house from a 22, 23-year-old who doesn't know who's never owned real estate and doesn't know very much about home ownership, you know? So while I was selling real estate, I had a lot of free time. And one of my clients had taken me for a ride in his small plane. I had never been in a small plane before. I think I was probably 23. And one of my customers said, would you like to come to the airport and we'll go for a ride in my plane? So I said, oh, I would love to. And we went up over North Jersey. I remember circling around Sussex, which is in the northwest corner of New Jersey. And I absolutely fell in love with flying. I remember thinking to myself, oh, my God, I love this. I want to learn how to fly. And, you know, of course, at the time, I didn't have any money. You know, I'm not really selling real estate. I'm living home with my parents. You know, not really, I don't know, sort of lost, you know, sort of, you know, I had gotten my degree. I wasn't using it. It was kind of not a good time in my life. But I discovered, you know, this immediate love for flying. So I kind of said to myself, I said, oh, my God, I have to learn how to do this. I don't know how, but I'm going to learn, you know. So I think it was maybe a year later when I had the idea of presenting myself to the flight school and just seeing if I could work there in exchange for flying lessons. So unbeknownst to me, the flight school was owned by a woman. So I thought, oh, this is great, you know. So one day I just, you know, showed up and I said, I really, really want to learn how to fly. You know, I don't have money. I know it's expensive. I can't afford it. But can I work maybe 2 or 3 hours for you in exchange for an hour's flying lesson? So she said yes. You know, so I started working for her, and I flew every chance I could get. And I think I got my private pilot's license within 6 months. It was quite fast because I flew, you know, I worked for a few hours, I'd fly, you know, and I was flying every chance I could get. So that was kind of where my initial interest in flying came from.
But then you kept taking lessons too. You could fly, you know, a Boeing 727, which I imagine is a much more complicated process.
Yes, yes. Well, after... well, I don't know how much you know about flying, but there are various licenses that you get. So after my private pilot's license, I continued. I basically was so enamored of flying, and I said, well, that's it. I'm going to become an airline pilot. So I did this really quickly. Over about 2 years, I got the rest of the licenses that are required. My next one after private pilot's license was an instrument rating. Then I got my commercial pilot's license. And then I went for flight training in Atlanta. I don't remember how long it was. It was a number of months. But I went for flight training to learn how to become a Boeing 727 flight engineer. And it was in Atlanta using FedEx airplanes. And I think, if I remember correctly, I think the instructors were Delta pilots who were moonlighting, you know, teaching people how to fly. And I remember I was the only woman in the class. I don't remember how many pilots there were, maybe between 25 and 30. And I definitely stood out. I was the only woman. And this was back in 1981 when I was working on my 727 qualification.
It's amazing. So, that would seem at a time when there would be plenty of women pursuing that. It's incredible that at that time, which seems not long ago at all, that it was still a male-dominated
right?
field.
Yeah, I think it's still, it's better now, but I think it's still rare when I fly on a plane and there's a female pilot, you know. I mean, that's very rare, even now, this many years later. So, so I guess it was about 80, 81, 82, I got my Boeing 727 flight engineer certificate, and then I immediately started applying for jobs with airlines all over the world, not just in the U.S., because English is the international language of aviation. Regardless of what country you're flying for, everyone speaks English. As far as on the radios on planes. So I researched. I remember going to the Clifton Library and researching every airline all over the world that operated Boeing 727 airplanes, which in those days that was like the most common plane that was flown by airlines. So I started sending resumes out. I started sending, just sending letters out all over the world. And around the beginning of 1982, out of the blue, I got a call from a Navy recruiter. And she said to me, she says, we heard that you're a pilot. The Navy's looking for pilots. We would really be interested in speaking with you. So I thought to myself, well, I have absolutely zero interest in the Navy, but I would really like to leave Clifton. And unless I have any other opportunities, maybe I should, and which I didn't at the time. Oh, also at that time, Ronald Reagan had laid off the air traffic controllers, so none of the airlines were hiring. So I had really bad timing. So I said, well, it couldn't hurt to talk to this recruiter. So I went and I spoke with her, and it turned out that the Navy at the time had a one-year delayed entry program so that I could sign a contract, I could have a year to myself to continue looking for flying jobs. If I didn't have a job with an airline, at least I would be in the Navy, in the flight program, and away from New Jersey. By then I was like in my late 20s, living with my parents. We were fighting, it was pretty miserable. It's pretty miserable to be in your, in your late 20s and still living at home. So one way or the other, I was going to be leaving, my parents' house, So, long story short, a year comes and goes. Nothing happened with the airline, so I ended up going in the Navy. And in the meantime, the Navy recruiter had said to me, well, we're not really looking for women pilots. And if the ones we are taking are coming out of the Naval Academy, why don't you come in the Navy anyway? And once you're in, surely you'll get picked up by the flight program, so which is what I did. I went in the Navy knowing I wasn't headed for the flight program, but I thought, well, surely once I finish officer school, I'll get picked up by the flight program. And long story short there, the Navy never let me fly. They basically assigned me to a series of boring paperwork jobs that I just was bored out of my mind, so which is why after about 7 years I left active duty.
And why didn't they let you fly? That seems, was that sexism?
It was partly sexism. It was partly because at the time women were not allowed in combat. So the women pilots that were allowed to fly, all they really could be useful for was for training male pilots. So in fact, once I was in the Navy, I went down to Pensacola and I met a couple of women pilots, and that's all they could do. They couldn't fly on aircraft carriers. They couldn't fly fighters. All they could do was train male pilots. That was the such a limited role that women had, women pilots had in the Navy at the time. And for me personally, I had three things going against me. The first being a woman. The second being that I was older and hadn't gone to the Naval Academy. I mean, I had zero interest in the Naval Academy. But that at the time, I think, was held against me. And also that I wore glasses. And for military flying, they require 20/20 uncorrected vision. And in my opinion, that's just a way to weed people out, because I was, if I do say so, I was a pretty terrific pilot. And you do not need to have 20/20 uncorrected vision. It's perfectly fine to wear glasses. You know, so I always thought that was just an arbitrary way to limit the number of people who would be qualified to fly. So basically, I had those three things going against me.
And when was it that you began your picking up your artwork again and drawing and deciding that's what seemed important to you?
That was in the mid-80s. By then, I had moved to Alexandria, Virginia. I was working at the Pentagon. I was completely miserable when I got there. And I was working a midnight shift. I was working from 11 at night to 7 in the morning in a sub-basement of the Pentagon on some war gaming stuff that I just had no interest in. I mean, I've always been a pretty liberal, everything about it was wrong for me. I mean, the job was wrong, the hours were wrong, everything was wrong. And I was so miserable. I wasn't challenged. And I started looking for something else to do with my time. And, I'd come home at 7 in the morning. I had basically a whole day ahead of me. You know, I had to sleep in there sometime, but I had, like, the daytime to find something else to do. So lucky for me, I found a local art school in Alexandria. There's an art center on the Potomac River in Alexandria. It's called the Torpedo Factory. And in addition to being a building of artist studios, they have an art school, a non-accredited art school for adults. So I started taking drawing classes. And I took like drawing 101 there. And I wasn't especially good. I guess because it had been so many years since I had done anything as far as art, I wasn't that good. But boy, did I have a good time! Most of the other students were women, for one thing. I was so tired of being at the Pentagon and among these macho warrior, you know, naval officers. I just was kind of fed up with being in such a masculine world that just being around the other women in these classes was just so wonderful. So I guess over a two-year period, I took every class I could, and I got pretty good after 2 years. I was taking lots of drawing classes. I had found a couple of wonderful teachers that I repeated classes with them. And so over a couple of years, I got really good, and I said, that's it. I'm leaving the Navy. I've had it with the Navy, and, you know, I'm going to leave and be a full-time artist. So in 1988, I resigned from the Navy because at the time they weren't letting people resign. I had to give them 1 year's notice. So sometime in 1988, I said, okay, I'm resigning effective a year from now. And that's what I did. And I think my last day was September 30th, 1989. And I haven't had another job. Well, I stayed in the reserves, but other than that, I haven't worked a full-time job other than being a full-time artist since 1989. I feel very fortunate to be able to do that.
And how did that begin to happen in 1989? What is it that launched your career as a full-time artist, and how did that begin commercially?
I have to say, thankfully, I had Brian. I had my future husband. We weren't married at the time, but He was so supportive. I mean, he backed me 100%. I mean, I was really terrified to give up the security of a regular paycheck, not to mention all the medical benefits and the free this and the free that, to go from that to being a potentially starving artist. But Brian was, you know, 100% behind me, and he backed me in whatever I wanted to do. He knew how miserable I was and how much I enjoyed doing art. So it was a good part of my decision was thanks to Brian, you know, that I had somebody to support me. And then I guess what I did while I was still in the Navy was I got really good at portraits because I really didn't have a clue on how I was going to make any money. But I thought, well, let me do portrait commissions. At least I can make a living that way, you know, or so I thought. So when I left in 1989, that was my thinking, that I would do portraits, and I did do portraits for about a year, and that was kind of unsatisfactory for a number of reasons. Because I was working in pastel, the portraits took me a really, really long time. The way I work, I spend like 2 or 3 months on a single piece, and that went for my portraits too. I wouldn't work on anything else. I'd work on one portrait for 2 or 3 months. And I always, I don't know why, but I would always undercharge. I would sort of underestimate how much time a portrait would take, and I always undercharge my customers. So I think I did portraits for about a year, maybe a little bit longer. Besides the fact that I was chronically undercharging, I also felt very constricted, and I thought, wow, I just left the most boring job, the Navy, in the world, and here I am now making boring art. There's something wrong, you know. So I stopped in 1990. I made my last portrait commission, and I said, that's it. I'm not doing any more commissions. So I started looking for something else, paint, and not really knowing where to look. I started working on still lifes, and not wanting to do like the typical fruit and flowers. I started working with stuffed animals and little figures, these painted gourds that were made to look like animals. They're made in Peru, some ceramic figures, and my work kind of took off from there. I was doing these tabletop still lifes with these little figures in them, and I was really enjoying the work. The work was getting good. People liked it. People responded to it. They had a narrative to them because you could look at the still life and say, oh, these little figures are talking and they're saying this and that to each other. So my kind of what I'm doing now basically evolved back to those tabletop still lifes.
And what enabled you to become a full-time artist? Were you represented by galleries right away? Did you begin selling that work right away?
It took a while. Actually, I was still the Torpedo Factory, the Art League, again, in Alexandria, was such a huge influence on my life when I think about it. They also had monthly juried shows. And I would enter the shows, and I think starting at in the late 80s, I would enter the shows, you know, and I wouldn't even get in, you know. But I was persistent. I'd keep entering, you know. I would keep working. I'd enter a show. Well, soon, maybe by like 1990 or so, I was not only getting in those shows, I was winning first prize, and so that kind of really gave me a confidence boost. I started entering juried shows, other juried shows locally. I think I did a bunch around. I would enter juried shows that have prize money. So, and I'd win. A lot of times I'd win first prize. I'd win $2,000 here. I'd win $1,000 here, you know. And I didn't have a lot of expenses. Brian was supporting me. you know, I didn't need a lot of money, and the little bit of money I did get from my art, and you know, would go back towards supplies, you know, and I actually had a nice little income from winning prizes for juried shows. So I did that. I don't remember how long I did that for, but I, you know, that kind of kept me going. The first real serious gallery that I had was in 1996. I was still in Virginia. It was the summer of 1996. Brian and I were traveling in Mexico, and I remember calling our house in Virginia just to check my messages. And oh my God, there's a message from Brewster Arts, which was a very prestigious gallery on 57th Street that showed Latin American artists. I had sent her slides a month or two prior to that. And she said to me, "Barbara, I have an opening. I would love to show your work in October." And I think this was like in August of 1996. So we get back from Mexico. I call her up. She says, "Yeah, I want to put you in a two-person show." And I'm like, "Oh my God, this is pretty major. This is like an important gallery. And here, you know, who the heck am I? This little person in Alexandria, you know?" But she loved my work. By then I was using Mexican folk art, and that fit in with the sensibility of the gallery. So I had a show with her, and the show did really well. It got reviewed. My work was really well received, and that was the beginning of one of my best gallery relationships to this day. And also around that time, around the summer of 96, I also connected with an artist rep, a person who's still a good friend of mine, who used to have a loft on Green Street in Soho, and she wanted to represent me. She basically would set up salon evenings for her artists and invite collectors, and we'd kind of mingle in an old-style salon event. So she was representing me. This gallery on 57th Street was representing me. So I was finding my career gradually, you know, New York was gradually pulling me up here. And I had decided, you know, oh my God, I need to be in New York. It's time to move. And I was able to move here in April of 1997. And I've been in New York ever since. And just love it.
How did the other four representations happening? Those are in different places, but this is
yes.
beginning of your
yes.
career, which sounds like that happened through meeting people and friends and
kind of that way. And actually, to be honest, sometimes back in the 90s, we were still using slides, right? I was really active. I had as a goal for myself, every single day I would send out a slide package to a gallery. I would research the galleries. It used to be, I mean, now it's so much easier to research online, but I would look at the Art in America annual, and I would look at the artists that they show. There were certain parts of the country where I was convinced my work would do really well. So I would just cold send slides, you know, a slide packet with some reviews and slides and stuff to galleries. And, the success rate when you do that is not very good. But every once in a while, I would actually find one, and they want to represent me. And that's pretty much, how I found a couple of my galleries. There was one in Northern California that I remember put out an artist call for a juried show. And I think I submitted a piece of work, and I don't remember exactly how this happened, but they really, really liked my work. But then I said, well, one drawback about my work is it's very fragile and it's difficult and expensive to ship. So I remember saying to them, well, I'd be happy to ship my work if you're going to keep it out there for a while. Basically, if you're going to represent me, I will gladly send my work out. But I don't want to send it out for a month show that, you know, I have to pay to get it there, and then I have to pay hundreds of dollars to get it back. I thought, that's not really a good deal, you know, good arrangement for me. So I kind of talked myself into them representing me. You know, they said, oh, yes, we love your work. You know, we do want to represent you. So, you know, I picked up the gallery there, and they turned out to be one of the best galleries I've ever had. They sold work. They paid me on time, you know, unlike so many galleries. The woman was a pleasure to work with. So there's roundabout ways. I found galleries in all different ways. One gallery.
But you did send a lot out cold. I mean, there was a lot of just cold letters.
I did. Yes. I think it's partly because I didn't go to art school. I didn't have connections. I basically had to start from the bottom. You know, I didn't have a lot of artist friends. You know, and I didn't know how else to do it. You know, I just would say, okay, well, I'm going to try this and see what happens. You know, I kind of still do that. I still like to try things, and hopefully I'm a little smarter now about what does and doesn't work, but I still have this mentality that I don't want to leave any stone unturned. You know, I'm always trying to find new opportunities and new places to show my work, you know. So.
Well, it reminds me a little bit of the book you wrote, the interview of you, which there's a link to in the text of this interview, when you said you had the attitude from the Navy of this idea of, if I remember correctly, full speed ahead.
Yes, exactly. That's partly because I didn't start out as a kid. You know, I often look back and I think, wow, if I had been an artist when I was a teenager, look how much further along I would be. You know, I started basically when I was in my 30s, and I feel like I lost a lot of time. So when I did start in 1989 being a professional artist, I felt like there was a lot of ground, a lot of lost time to make up for. And, you know, I kind of just jumped in and figured things out as I went. And, you know, whatever I needed to do or felt like I needed to do or felt like this is something I should try, I would just do it, you know, so.
And then you got into photography. Can you talk a little bit about how you began to make photographs and that process? What started that?
Yes. Well, my paint, I've always worked, not always, but for a long, long time, I've worked from stage photographs. I would set up my Mexican figures in a room of my house or in my apartment. Brian would photograph them for me with our 4x5 view camera, and we'd shoot like two negatives, and then I'd pick one of those and make a 20x24 photograph to look at while I painted. I think, as I mentioned, from the time I was a kid, I could always draw or paint anything if I could see it, so I need a visual reference. So Brian used to photograph these setups for me. Well, after I lost Brian on 9/11, I, in addition to all the other, horror and everything I went through, I lost my collaborator. I didn't have anyone to take photographs of my setups. I had no way to continue making new work.
Now, so, I'm sorry, but yeah. Losing Brian on 9/11 was specifically because he was on one of the hijacked planes that was flown into the Pentagon. Was that correct?
Yes. Yes. He was my husband was a brilliant economist. He worked at the Pentagon. He worked at the time for Donald Rumsfeld. He was just brilliant. And on 9/11, well, once a month, he used to give a guest lecture in Monterey, California, at the Naval Postgraduate School. And on 9/11, he was on his way to give that lecture. He left from Dulles early in the morning and, you know, and got on the plane that was hijacked. You know, the worst nightmare, horrible day of my life. you know, even this many years later, it's something that you never get over. I mean, it gets a little bit easier, but something you never get used to.
Of course,
to, that,
that's absolutely devastating. No, you never get over those kind of things. It's overwhelming and will remain so. So then after that, you not only lost, you know, a husband and partner and in your activities and huge support system, but you were saying that that's also what began propelling you into photography?
Yes. Well, because Brian had been so integral to my work, I had to learn how to do what, you know, take those photographs that he had been taking for me. So the following summer, I'm pretty sure it was the summer of 2002, the first, you know, that's how long it took me before I was ready to get back to work. And that summer, I took a photography class at the International Center of Photography on 4x5 view cameras. It was a one-week workshop, like I think 8 hours a day, like Monday through Friday. And I said to myself, oh, my God, I have to get back to work. So the first step for me to get back to work was to learn how to take these reference photos that I was using, you know, to look at to make a painting. So, so I took a one-week workshop, and much to my surprise, I guess just by watching Brian, I mean, I had never been a photographer before that. I kind of always avoided cameras. I don't know why.
It's not a simple process. I mean, really, and I took technical photography in college using view cameras and all of that. I mean, maybe you did view it as simple. At the time, I viewed it as quite complicated and still think it is a lot to think about.
Yes, it is, and it really teaches you photography. But I guess what happened was Brian had been a photographer. Brian learned photography from his father. I think from the time Brian was like 6 or 7 years old, he had been a photographer. He was an excellent photographer. And just by watching him over the number of years that he would, you know, I would basically set up a scene in our house, and I would watch Brian set up everything, take light measurements, you know, measure this, measure that, compute what the exposure should be. And he would explain everything he was doing, but I really didn't have any incentives to learn, you know. But I guess by osmosis, just being there, I picked up a lot of knowledge that I didn't realize I had. So I took this one-week course, and immediately afterwards, I was able to make 4x5 negatives, which is what I needed to continue working. So thank God. I mean, I was pretty motivated, too, because I really wanted to get back to work. But I took this one class, and I said, gee, this isn't as hard as I thought it was going to be. And I said, well, maybe I should go back and start studying photography from the beginning. So again, at ICP, International Center of Photography, I started with photography 101. I forgot what it was called exactly, black and white photography. I started taking a whole series of photography classes and, starting with the basics and just working my way up. And over, maybe a year and a half, 2 years, by the end of that process, I was taking classes on developing my own prints, my own color prints, and making like large color prints. And over that time, I got really interested in photography, unbeknownst to me, who never really had any particular interest. But I guess, because I had no one else to shoot and make the reference photos that I've always used to make my pastel paintings, I got really interested in it, and it got pretty good. I guess because I was so interested, you know, I took a whole series of classes at the International Center of Photography, and over a couple of years, got pretty good as a photographer. And so much so that in 2009, I had my first solo photography show at a gallery called H.P. Garcia in New York.
Well, when I look at the images, you know, I mean, congratulations on that show, and also
the images themselves are seem so much more than, which of course they are, of documents of your work or how you're setting them up. They have a quality that your work has. They seem like paintings to me. Even the richness of the blacks and how you're using that.
Yes.
They haven't replicated painting, but you're seeing, it seems to me you're making photographs as a painter, and it's not only approaching that, it has a life of its own that seems quite powerful.
Yes, yes. One common comment that people used to say about my pastel paintings, because they were so photorealist, people used to say that my pastel paintings look like photographs. So I consciously, when I started studying photography, I said, oh, what if I turn that around? What if I make photographs that look like paintings? So I started, when I would shoot a photograph, I would put gels in front of the lens. I do all these things to kind of distort the image. I wouldn't even focus the camera sometimes. I wouldn't even point the camera. I would just hold the camera up with these gels in front of it and just kind of experiment and click the shutter and say, gee, I wonder what photo I just took. You know, I was totally experimenting and trying to make photographs that were more like paintings, you know, not straightforward like photorealist photos. I was trying to make photos that looked more painterly. So that was kind of an interesting, switch, because my painting admittedly was very photorealist. I guess because I just developed a lot of facility with pastel, and I guess because I was working from pretty straightforward photographs, my paintings got very realistic. So that when I started studying photography, I sort of wanted to make images that look more like paintings. And it sort of was a natural progression.
They're beautiful. You have a beautiful body of work. And I love the photographs. I always like photography, but I like the relationship between them. And are you still shooting photographs, or how has that played into your studio practice now?
Yes, I'm still shooting photographs. I think now they're coming more together. I really was very, very photorealist. At a certain point, I remember being highly insulted when, at a particular exhibition, someone who didn't know my work at all looked at one of my paintings and said, oh my God, that looks just like a photograph. And I knew they meant it as a compliment, but I was so insulted. I said to myself, oh my God, I spend months on this piece. And all they can say, the only thing that they can relate to that brings them into this piece is that it looks like a photograph. So I felt like a failure. And I said, I remember thinking, oh my God, I am not going to make photorealist work anymore. And it's been a gradual kind of letting go of the photorealism for me. I think the work I'm making now is more painterly than ever. But it's been kind of a reverse process, I guess, because early on I had developed so much technical facility. I could pretty much draw anything I can see in pastel, that for me to leave out things, to work more out of my head rather than to just reproduce what I'm looking at, has been sort of an opposite process from what you would think would be, would be like more natural, I guess. You know, I've been gradually leaving out detail, just gradually becoming less and less realistic, less and less photorealistic as time goes on.
And you're still shooting photographs as well, or not as much
yes,
anymore?
Yes, I still am. Yes, I always work from photographs. In fact, I'm looking at a piece I have on my easel now. There's a photograph on the left side that I find myself using the photographs less and less, working more out of my head, making things up, you know, basically using the photograph as a rough guide of what I want to paint in pastel. I guess years and years ago, I would be not exactly copying, but I would be pretty true to the photograph. And now I consciously don't use it nearly as much.
Barbara, it's been wonderful talking to you today. And in closing, is there a next project you're doing or something that you'd like to achieve now or next that you're looking toward to that full speed ahead would mean a specific direction to? Or are you just following the progress in your studio to see where it leads?
I've always been sort of a person who works kind of slowly, and I kind of just follow the process. I mean, I think I mentioned I started this series in 2007, and I make maybe 4 or 5 paintings in a year. So I kind of just continue, you know, with this process and see where it goes. I guess on the business side of things, I have some interesting developments. But as far as the creative side, I kind of let the work unfold, you know, slowly. That seems to be my way of working.
And the developments on the business side that are exciting?
I'm trying to work less and less with galleries. I'm trying to do more with social media. I have a social media person that I work with. That's a whole other conversation, I think. But I'm trying to be more independent as an artist and to be less beholden to galleries these days.
And to sell things directly.
Correct. Yeah, for sure.
Barbara, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, thanks, Brainerd. I really enjoyed it. I'm a big fan of yours, as you know.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.